Capital 263.
To politics and beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
And I'm Tawanda Henry Beattie. Welcome to the best political podcast in the Second Republic of Zimbabwe.
Are we tatanga?
I don't know.
Andy, some people are still waiting to appear in front of the bench.
Look, whatever. The election has happened, so whatever the final outcome will be in the second, will be in the Second Republic.
So, just on that, you know, I've actually found this whole Second Republic thing quite interesting or funny or weird. We're saying Mugabe was the first republic.
So, it's an interesting point. It's a good question because, yeah, we would be saying Mugabe was the first republic, but then it would have to be an admission that the events of November 17 were unconstitutional, so they ended that republic. So, by this election, we're returning to republicanism. So, it's very interesting when you see Emerson or an official government statement that we're happy to be in the Second Republic when previously they had refused to say that they were in a coup. Or a coup. It's a coup.
They're not chicken. Yeah, I've found it interesting. I understand where the MDC logic was coming from, but when I heard ED use it, I was like, well, that's a bit strange.
I don't know why he latched onto that, but it's obviously an admission.
To be fair, I get it from a point of not having a proper mandate, which he knows he didn't have. He didn't have an elected mandate, and so now he does.
No, those things are all like we all understand those. It's just that at the time they were refusing to admit that they didn't have a mandate. Is more what I'm saying is that...
Or publicly admit, that is true.
Yeah, publicly admit. I mean, when challenged, you know, the voice of the people is the voice of God was the response to you don't have
you
an electoral mandate.
And the voice of the people spoke this last... when was election day? It was on last week, Monday. Yeah.
Yeah, on the 30th.
Last week Monday, the voice of the people.
Yeah, so today, for those that don't know, we're recording on the 7th.
6th or 7th. I'm still in the 6th. But anyway.
7th of August. August.
Tapinamna August.
Yeah.
So the people went out to vote, and in numbers, they turned out.
75% turnout, apparently.
Was that turnout?
Yeah.
I was trying to see if I can find it for the parliamentary, but I can't find it. So, they're obviously supposed to be the same.
Supposed to
be the same. But yeah, 75% turnout. That's high. That's the highest we've had in terms of turnout since 1980. I think 1980 is the only time we've had a higher turnout. Some of the elections, I was looking back at it, some of the election turnouts in like 1996 was like 32%. This last one, the last election, I think, was just above 50%. 2013, if I'm not mistaken. Or was that 2008? But one of the two. So, really high turnout. Congratulations to Zimbabwe for Zimbabweans coming out to vote. It was very important that they did so. I'd obviously like to see the breakdown in terms of
which provinces had high turnouts lower turnouts, and
exactly women as well. You know, those demographic statistics will be interesting to look at.
I think perhaps we might
once they're publicly available.
We need to. Yeah, we might have to do proper breakdown of that, maybe with Dr. Miles Tendi or someone.
Yeah, definitely. It would be telling, you know, just in terms of where our democracy is at, what sort of trends we might be able to expect in the future, just what sort of what people were thinking around the country. Obviously, one of the key things that we can take out from this is we have a divided
a rural-urban divide.
A serious rural-urban divide in terms of the electorate, in terms of the voting patterns, or in terms of the voting results. We also just simply have a divide. 50.8% of people, according to ZEC, voted for Emmerson Mnangagwa, which means...
It's by no means a ringing endorsement of the president.
It's not. 49.2% of people didn't vote for him. And that's a huge, you know, that's a 50-50 split. So we are, you polarized. Know, down the middle. Very polarized. It can't get more polarized than this.
Yeah.
It really can't. But yeah, let's get into it. We'll start with, as the results were announced, we'll start with issues to do with the
parliamentary election.
Parliamentary election. Talk about what happened there, and then from there we'll just move on to the presidential election and discuss things that happened there, and obviously things that happened with regards to the election itself and results coming out and all of that.
Yeah. What was the final tally for the parliamentary result?
Just before we get to that, just wanted to say it on the surface, and this is obviously someone looking at it from who wasn't there. The process seemed to go quite smoothly. It would be nice actually to get some people on who did vote, but from what I gather, lots of people went early. Obviously, you know, there was an eagerness, but really, there were incidents in some places. You know, some people couldn't vote. I think immediately of Fungai Machirori, she posted her incident where she was on the voters' roll twice, and it wasn't during the cleanup process that wasn't sorted out, so she was unable to vote. But most people who I spoke to said that it was fine. The process went by, you know, quite smoothly. They got there, they checked their names, they went into the booth, and they did their thing. They cast their ballot. I don't know if there's any sort of like stories just on that you have.
No, I think, yeah, voting in itself was generally problem-free. I mean, obviously, TB couldn't find his name on the voters' roll at 3 polling stations, so that was a bit of a kerfuffle. And yeah, there were isolated incidents like that where I know candidates and some people couldn't find their names on the voters' roll at specific polling stations. But if they had the resources to go to the district polling station, they generally were able to sort it out. But I mean, it's easy in Harare to go from Glethwen Farm to Oriel or Chizipiti, but in other areas it was quite difficult. So I don't know if there's any statistics on that, but I know of some candidates that had to run around and do that, so I'm assuming that trend would reflect itself, not in a major way, but it would also have, some people would have had that, but that's pretty much the major issue.
There was a couple of things that I saw online that I actually just curious about. So the first one was the missing polling station.
Yeah.
And I never actually followed up on that to find out what actually happened there. And I haven't seen anything written about it to further explain.
Just said that they were told to go and vote somewhere else. It almost seems like someone just forgot. And the polling station equipment and materials had been put as a sub-polling station at another location.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, from Zek's perspective, and I'm not surprised that some of these things happened. Simply based on the manner in which they've been, or a lot of the things that happened in the run-up to the election itself. But I think generally speaking, there weren't calamitous or nothing reported that I would say was like calamitous, where you're like, wow, this is just simply bad and terrible.
Yeah, no, they did well. And in terms of the logistics of voting day itself, you know, besides acts of God, like that polling station that ended up being in the middle of a bushfire.
Yeah, that was also quite strange.
Funny candidate and I choose what I'll go away, Papa.
Was that not in Norton?
I don't know. Possibly. Who are you blaming, Chris? In terms of actual voting, I'm just looking through this now. There's nothing that else that we can really say was the problem. You know, people in urban areas always complain about standing in queues too long. You'd think they'd be used to it with all the bank queues they have to stand in. But there was generally a belief in some people complaining that ZEC is intentionally going slow in Harare, but I don't think anyone failed to vote as a result of it. I think people are just impatient and were being a bit alarmist.
Interesting voter turned up on the day, RG Mugabe.
Yeah. He was one of. Did they count his votes as an assisted vote? Because Grace definitely assisted him with that.
Bona was the one who was there for a long time, and then Grace came over afterwards. But the day before, he came out and, you know, in a shock press conference, out of the blue, spanner in the works, so to speak, came out and he said he wasn't voting for ED. Said he's being tormented. I found that whole press conference very, it was hilarious, you know what I mean? For a number of reasons. First and foremost, they should have gotten him a different chair. Man was slipping and sliding down
his chair.
You know, secondly, a lot of the things he was saying were very hypocritical and ironic. You know, he was talking about the treatment. So he was talking about the treatment of his family members and how people can't come to visit him and how people are being harassed every time they come visit him.
And they're afraid to visit him. Some who lost the farm, they took the property.
Some people are losing property. Some people are out of the country and they can't return. And I'm like, so you, in my head, I'm thinking, well, so this is exactly how people lived when you were in charge.
Yeah.
You know, this is a monster of your creation. People are literally just carrying on the things that were done under your leadership. It just so happens that you are now
the one on the receiving end.
Yeah.
And then his complaint that the pension that he received was not the agreed on amount.
$457,000 American dollars.
Yeah, that's not rands.
Yeah, American dollars. We can't even go to issues. It's a pension, sha. I mean, who in this day has a pension?
We should ask him about 2008 when our parents' pensions were wiped out by his disastrous policies.
So that entire thing was, you know, but obviously it really was a farce. But at the same time, you can see that man is craving for the attention. He's craving for, you know, to be in some sort of spotlight and limelight. And what, you know, one thing, so when he did go out to vote and he voted in Highfield, as he's always done, people were screaming his name.
Yeah.
People were screaming, Gushungo, Gushungo, Gushungo. And I wonder if when he got back into the car, you know, he asked himself again,
he should have put himself on the ballot. I think that narrative, I don't know why those people were doing that, but that's definitely something you can believe in his head. And if he's surrounded by sycophants and people like that, and then the first time he's really out of the house, he sees that. It's the first thing he can believe. And then to make matters even worse, and when we get into the presidential results, we can also then go into this. He can say, look, as you can see, I always said it was opposition people in the towns that marched against me. And they've always marched against me. But the rest of the country still loved me. And if you look at the election results,
well, to be fair, right?
In terms of
a percentage, and once you break in terms of a percentage, he's performed better than ED. If we are then to say that if 75% of people had turned out to vote in previous elections or whatever it was, then he's gotten a higher percentage of the vote. So he could make an argument for himself. What I think it was, though, and you know, you asked, you don't know why people did that. I think genuinely there are people out there who still love Mugabe. They love him, the icon and the idea of him and some of the things that he claimed to stand for. You know, I've always said, had he retired in the 90s, he'd have been a living legend. You know what I mean? Like just
1998.
So just before shit hit the fan.
No, guys, isn't that when Black Thursday happened, when the Zim currency lost about...
Wasn't that 97?
Was it 97 when he decided going to give all war vets $50,000 cash?
Yeah. No, I think, you know, even at any point, but we can discuss Mugabe's legacy on another day. But yeah, that was you know, just an interesting tidbit, him coming out and the things that happened there. So yeah, onto the parliamentary elections. Any surprises for you?
No, I think none at all. None at all. I mean, there's statements we made before. I mean, let's just give the overview. What was the final tally?
Yeah, so in terms of the parliamentary seats, just to break it down, ZANU-PF won 145 seats, and the MDC Alliance won 63 seats. There was one independent candidate and one member from NPF that won, and that's all 210 constituencies. Obviously, the split, if you look at it, ZANU-PF, let me see if I have it here, in terms of the provinces and how they break down, I don't have it. But most ZANU-PF won most, or rather, MDC won in Matabeleland North. So people of Kariba, Vic Falls, Wange, those areas, they won Bulawayo, obviously. I think ZANU got one seat in Bulawayo, one more than they'd won before previously. Harare, they cleared the entire place. And then they also won in places in you know, around
Harare the country. South, they lost Harare South.
Oh yeah, they lost Harare South. My bad.
That ended up coming up later.
Yeah, so they lost one. But Midlands as well, they picked up Manicaland. They picked up as well. This is the MDC and ZANU-PF. Pretty much, if you look at the map is very green, and then you know bits of red here and there. But onto some of the interesting ones that we spoke about before. So some of the interesting ones we spoke about in the previous Harare. We can start with Mount Pleasant.
Pleasant.
Yeah. So of the independent candidates, and there were many.
Actually, there were a lot.
Before
Mount Pleasant pitted.
It's clear that in this election or Zimbabwean elections are a two-horse race. It's either you are in MDC or you are in ZANU-PF.
Or you are
Temba Mliswa.
Yeah.
Or you are Temba Mliswa. Because everyone else who stood as an independent got a hiding. The best performing independent, I believe, and I could be corrected, I think was Fadzai Mahere, who got 4,388 votes. and she came third in the Mount Pleasant constituency to Samuel Banda of the MDC Alliance, who won with 9,357 votes. And she lost to Jason Passadi as well, who got 5,295 votes. And that was pretty much how it worked for all of the constituencies.
Yeah. It's we need to talk about that, the responses of the independents after the loss. I mean, Fadzi lost, she ran a good race. Jessima Jome lost, her race was perhaps, you know, she arrived late to the game. Pastor Evan lost, and a bunch of other, you know, smaller...
Povo Yese.
I don't even remember who was in Povo, but the responses of the independent candidates are very interesting. And I think, like, you know, we always joked about whether Povo was a party and not a party, just like it was a coup and not a coup. And
yeah.
I genuinely believe that they had designs on making this a party, such that the losses, as I don't remember her name. What was her name? Was it Dudu something? I don't know.
Yeah.
As explained by them, you know, it really hurt. And I know losing hurts, but you don't insult your electorate.
Your constituent. Duduzile Nyirongo.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Is I was reading one of her tweets. She said, I went to every single house in my ward and they still voted for the MDC Alliance candidate. Maybe they just didn't like you. Like,
that's true. I mean, so for me, like, but I hear you. I completely understand. I think, you know, a lot of people have said different things on this. I think the first is that party politics is very strong. It's branding, but it's also attached to ideologies. People aren't just voting for individuals. They're voting for the party in terms of what the party itself stands for. And you can trace back, as much as we might disagree with some of the things that, you know, some of these parties do, you can trace back ZANU-PF's ideology, at least on paper, and what people think it stands for and believe it stands for. You can do the same for the MDC. Parties are also built out of... Parties don't just emerge from a leader. You don't just have one person come out and say, I'm starting a party. Parties emerge from people, right? And the MDC was a workers' party. It was a students' party. You know what I mean? Like, it came from
those a group roots.
Of people who could, from those roots, who could identify with it and place themselves amongst it. ZANU-PF had a large peasant base, which it's still, you know, rural base today. It's still got that connection to the people and that history. With the independent candidates, I think one of the key shortcomings was a lot of them were riding on their brand, their individualness.
It wasn't an organic movement.
It wasn't. But what you'll find is you'll find that some people can connect with you as a person and would say, well, you know, I see myself in Fadzi. And so I can vote for somebody like Fadzi, right? But what happens to the person who doesn't see themselves in you? If you are saying that you stand on whatever particular principle, they might not see themselves in you, but they can believe and follow in those principles and ideology that you stand for. And I think, you know, it goes across for a lot of these independent candidates is they were the brand and the name behind it. Whereas if we now look at the MDC and I'll pick a constituency like Harare West, where
Jesse versus Joanna Mamombe.
Yeah, where Joanna beat Jesse.
But she didn't just beat Jesse.
Let me actually pull it up.
She won by 20,000 votes.
Yeah, that's huge. That's massive.
She right? wallops Jesse.
Completely, completely. And now this isn't somebody who... Jesse isn't a nobody. Jesse was the incumbent, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And Jesse was a two-term incumbent.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so she got 20,045 votes. Jesse came third. Jesse even lost out to the ZANU-PF guy. She got 4,021 votes. But she beat the incumbent because people weren't... I think people weren't looking specifically at Jesse. They knew. They were like, this is somebody who's come from our party. But it was more the ideology of the party and the party itself that people were voting for. People are voting parties into power. They aren't necessarily voting individuals
into
power. And you're looking at it from a perspective of saying, we want to have a strong party. And yeah. You can only have a strong party when you have more of your individuals in that position.
And you know, look, we're both studying politics-related degrees and have had a look at this, but we would have told them this for free as soon as Morgan Tsvangirai passed away and Mugabe was deposed. Could you get into a party?
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
it was a tragic misreading of the political political landscape.
Yeah,
and you know, then we must go ahead.
And to be fair, if we you know. It's been a resurgence of both political parties simply because there's new leadership in both of them.
The base would have been, or even new bases are being re-energized. People are being re-energized.
That's completely true. But, you know, some of the other interesting ones, Terence Mokope out there in Harare East. Where is it? Lost.
Thankfully. Yeah. Terence Mokope lost emphatically as well. That was another 20,000 past MDC Alliance victory.
Yes, 20,592 to Tendai BT. Terence Mokope came second with 8,000 votes. He did lose. Obed Kutu, why he was even trying? I mean, shambolic. 1,269 votes. Massive loss. Harare South was an interesting one, and we'll talk about Harare South. Actually, we can do it now. Harare South is the only one that went to ZANU-PF, and this one has a lot of votes. So ZANU-PF won by 24,503 votes, and that was Tongai Mnangagwa, ED's nephew, who won. And then Shadrick Mashayamombe came second with 21,366 votes, and Tichawana Saurombe came third with 7,816 votes.
Saurombe is... Which party?
MDC Alliance. So you had two MDC Alliance
candidates. So
who and an MDC candidate, Desmond Jambaya, who got 4,016 votes. So in total, the three MDCs had over 35,000 votes.
But because of their inability to come
together, they lost out by and Mnangagwa won by, you know, 3,000 votes. That was the difference. So if the MDCT guy wasn't there, you know, Shadrick Mashayamombe might have taken it, maybe. Or, you know, they would have split between him and Saurombe. And this happened, I think, in another 11 constituencies. Raj Modi, who won in Blawayo, he won in a similar fashion, where he just had the highest number of votes. Two MDC Alliance candidates, they split the votes between them, or MDC Alliance and MDCT, and they lose out. It happened in Chibutu West.
It happened in, I think, at the last count, in at least 16 constituencies. So it was literally, you know, the difference between... it gave them ZANU the supermajority.
Yeah, it did.
The alliance candidates happened in at least six constituencies, which would have brought them to the majority, would have denied ZANU the supermajority. If you then include MDCT it probably goes up to 20.
I don't think it goes up to 20. I think, if I'm not mistaken, POV said 12, but I haven't checked the stats myself. I know Chegutu West, for example, 104 votes was the difference. Dexter Nduna. Oh, no, this was the one that got overturned, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was overturned and given to MDC Alliance.
Yes. Okay, yeah, so this one doesn't even count. I was like, wait, something's wrong here. That one was overturned. But, you know, there's a number of constituencies. And this is something, you know, Douglas Monsoro came out himself and said this is where one of our failings were. And I completely agree that, you know, this was something that I think they really should have worked on. And this is where I think primary elections should have been a thing. Because if they'd gone to primaries and you'd lost, you'd then be fielding yourself as an independent candidate and not an alliance candidate. But and I think
how were the papers filed?
Auntie, you just needed a signature from the party in Ngirigini. And for example, you have Komichi and who's the other guy? Timba. Timba is the chief elections officer, I think, for the president of the MDC, and Komichi is the chief elections officer for the party. So you have two people who are running the same job pretty much, who could probably sign off on both on one issue, on the same issue. So it could have been, and I'm not saying this is what happened, but because of the way that the authority or the structure was organized, you had two people, and this is just that I know of, who could potentially have signed to endorse you as the candidate.
Yeah.
So it's those kind of divisions. Or it could have been that, you know, because you're in the alliance, maybe you are from PDP, and you use your PDP connections within the alliance to get yourself nominated for the seat. Yeah, I'm not sure how it worked.
I think what happened with the seats that you see there, and in fact what happened in Matt South was it was basically the
MDC
alliance member, the MDCT or original MDC, Chamisa's MDC members decided that they were stronger candidates than Washman's members and decided to impose themselves there. Washman was seized with something else and didn't fight for his seats. Whereas when they tried to do that in Harare and to settlement Chikwinya, luckily the president of the PDP, Tendaibiti, was also close to Chamisa and is not someone that would let something like that happen. So it became a choice of, was your leader in the alliance willing to really fight for you and stop something like that happening? It just happens that, you know, PDP members that ended up running all got their seats protected because Tendaibiti fought really hard to have those seats protected. Settlement Chikwinya is the first one. At the day of nomination court, there was another alliance member there, and there were phone calls made, and the guy caved.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is it. I really think that, you know, and we spoke about whether, you know, which approach was better in terms of going to primary elections, and that had they been better organized, this was avoidable. But now it's happened, and so
I think,
you know, that's it.
I think ultimately, yeah, that's the one takeaway that the MDC Alliance will have to take away from this election. We need to be better organized. And my thing is, look, we give Zek a hard time, but they had a year or more since Since voter registration to basically organize for an election. Chamisa essentially had 7 months to organize a party for the election. And like I kept reminding people before the election, you don't realize how dead MDC and Harvest House was. And a lot of that has to do with the Secretary General of the party and the Secretariat of the party, is that it had been allowed to decay. There are certain people who run a tough ship, and if you speak to anyone who has worked or been through Harvest House under Washman or under Tendai Biti, Jagi is brilliant in his own way. I just don't think he runs as tight a ship as Washman on, just because of whom they are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the structures and how people operate, but definitely what the MDC pulled off in this election must be commended, in terms of, you know, just the sheer number of votes. They're up from the 2013 position, but they must, I hope for them, and this is for, you know, going forward for the future of the party, they come to terms with some of their inefficiencies and issues in terms of just organizing and professionalizing themselves. And this is something I think we spoke about before in terms of how professional an institution is the MDC. What are just the day-to-day organizing structures of the MDC? You know, do you have a secretary? Are there people to answer phones? Are there people to, you know, pass information, messengers, and that sort of thing? How do those things on a day-to-day basis run? Obviously, there's a lot of things that, you know, we can talk about in terms of an election. An election's an expensive affair to conduct, and obviously, I don't think we all know that the MDC was strapped for cash. And these are some of the things that contributed to some of their failings. But going forward, it's important that they take a step back, review, analyze, and say, okay, how do we get to put our best foot forward? And once you've done that, it's going and looking and saying, how do we build our structures up from the ground up across the country? A lot of action takes place in Harare, but as the election shows you, Harare is not Zimbabwe. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done elsewhere. And there's an opening, because the MDC, as we've seen from the election results, has an opening in rural areas. They've increased their visibility there. Now it's time to actually get down and sort of start establishing, whether it's a party office or a, you know, something like that sort, just so that there's that regular contact and solidifying of structures nationally.
All right. So obviously we'll go in to this. We might have a post-election episode when all the dust is properly settled. So we can move on, but obviously it's going to be Congress when the wheat and the chaff need to be separated, and the party needs to
reunite
and destroy each other and get all those splits that are coming, get all those things done this year or in the next Congress.
I don't think that there's going to be room for splits. And I'll tell you why. Is this election has showed us there's only room for two parties in Zimbabwe. I don't know how any other political party, and I really would be impressed, is going to build a base. Because this election shows you need 2.2 million votes to win the election, right? Out of 5 million voters.
Yeah.
Right? How do you from ground up convince 2 million people to come to your side?
You can't. And here's the thing, is like, you can't. They can be as far as I see it, Chamisa is the next presidential candidate in 2023. So by splits, I mean, basically, it's going to be, unlike Mark Kupe, we didn't have enough time to really tell them, the people, that the MDCTs doesn't exist anymore. It's no longer an option. So those 45,000 votes that she got are not necessarily as a result of her own accessibility or popularity. She didn't campaign anywhere.
No, yeah, that's.
And but
that's,
she still beat exactly. out. She still beat out Nkosana Moyo. She still beat out everyone. We can now perfect segue anyway to get into the presidential results.
Yeah, perfect segue. So presidential results, obviously. Emmerson Mnangagwa won with 2,460,000 votes, 463. Nelson Chamisa second with 2,147,000 votes, 436. And then Thokozane Kupe, 45,573. Literally, that's 2.1 million less than Chamisa, right? 2.1 million less. That's mad in terms of just the gap, the massive gap between second and third, you know? Going down the list, shout out to Joseph Makamba Busha.
Yeah.
No, Joseph Makamba Busha, who was never on my radar, but came fourth with 17,556.
So his name was first.
Yeah, that's literally, that's what I believe. His name was first, and then he just got lucky. Nkosana Moyo, I honestly think that's what it was.
Yeah.
Nkosana Moyo came fifth with 50,223. You know, he beat Manju, who was seventh. Evaristo Chikanga, I have no idea who this guy is.
Who? Yeah.
And he beat Maimjuru. He got 13,141.
Do you know what I think will happen with Evaristo Chikanga? Rebuild Zimbabwe. What? I think he stole votes from Noah Manyika, build Zimbabwe Alliance. I'm serious.
I don't think so. No,
but think about
so.
Chris. Think about this.
Yeah.
You are an undecided voter. You've decided, I'm going to vote for that build guy. And then the first build Zimbabwe you see is Chikanga, because Chikanga obviously would have been on that left and high.
Eish, man.
So you don't bother going all the way down to build Zimbabwe, because you don't remember Noam Anyika, but you remember the party unions build something.
You know, it's a possibility, guy. But the gap between Evaristo Chikanga and Noam Anyika was about 11,000 votes. So if you're telling me 11,000 people
made that mistake, guys.
Okay, the margin of error is too high. Anyway,
no,
okay,
Manika
okay,
had. Will I okay. am?
let's deal with all these jokey characters so that Tozenda could the main matters of the election. But yeah, so for me, the most exciting result of this one is number 17 in this election was... Oh, by the way, Ambrose Mtindiri got 4,000, you know, votes. Yeah. NPF, completely destroyed. But we'll come back to how, you know, people were destroyed. But Brian Mtegi, shout out to him, independent candidate.
Yeah.
2,747 votes, number 17. Guess who he beat by 9 votes? Love Moment.
Maduku.
7,238. Guess who he also beat? Noah Manyika of Build Zimbabwe Alliance lost. So did Elton Mangoma. Elton Steers Mangoma. They all lost. And for me, this is crazy because Noah Manyika was on this podcast.
We actually had him on the radar.
Noah Manyika was on this podcast. We had him on the radar. We thought he'd be at least in the top five. I think if I'm not mistaken, our prediction went Emerson, Nelson, Kupe, Joyce Mujuru actually.
Joyce Mujuru. Kupe.
Oh yeah, so he was maybe like tops Kupe and then Noah Manyika or Nkosana Moyo.
Nkosana. He was, and even worse, Manyika fielded candidates more, unlike some of these other guys who didn't actually
who
have
ran.
MP candidates, who ran as independent system. Manyika fielded BZA candidates and kuwanda kongwede maposta ake.
No, Manyika ran a campaign from last year, before that even. I think
2016.
He came onto the scene in 2016. He ran a campaign the entire year last year. He campaigned this year, right? He was on this podcast. He did TV. He did radio. He put his name out there, and he only got 2,678 votes.
He would have lost to Fadzi in Mount Pleasant.
In Mount Pleasant. This, for me, shows that there is no space for new political parties. And perhaps, as I said before, you know, parties come out of a people and not of a person. And that was Noah Manyika. Noah Manyika was just him. He didn't have a base. But I honestly don't see where anybody on this list, the other, you know, 21 names, is going to find 2 million people. And if we look at our voting, if we look at the population, and in terms of, you know, ZANU targets its rural population, right? That is where their core voters are. MDC has urban, right? But aside from that, MDC, as we said, was born out of the of a workers
students
and students
and the workers.
Party, right? I don't see, simply because, you know, unemployment is so high in Zimbabwe, I don't see, even if another party wanted to try to do so out of the trade unions, you can't, because those people already belong to the MDC. I don't see how you're moving them away from there, right? Maybe if you say that the informal sector, but the informal sector is made up of people who are in the MDC because they used to come from the workers.
Yeah.
They used to be in the factories. They moved to the informal sector. They remain loyal to the MDC. If you say you're going out to the rural areas, now, for with the cities, it's a lot easier to organize because there's Harare, Bulawayo, Mutare, and then, you know, all these smaller satellite places. But, they, you know, you can Okwekwe, Gweru, Mashingo. You can hit 10 or so places. But if we say that you want to do the rural area route, how do you target nationally the way ZANU-PF has done so? You simply cannot. Because in Uzumba, there's 45,000 voters in total, right? Or not in total, but maybe 50,000. Yeah, 50,000 voters in total.
And they're,
you know,
spread out geographically.
And they spread out, right? In Chiredzi, that's another 60-something thousand voters there. How do you target all of these people to build to that 2 million? You simply can't. Harare is different. Harare has 900,000 registered voters. If you get all 900,000, we're all halfway there.
Yeah.
Pretty much, which is why it works for a thing. We really are a two-party system, and I wonder going forward how people are going to attack, how people are going to structure themselves. All of these independent candidates we've seen, all of these things, which is why I don't think for the MDC they have much to worry about. I think if someone like Thokozane Kupe wants to do politics, she has to go back.
Yeah.
Otherwise, just disband. Everyone
no,
else,
just
that's it. Go and farm.
Go and farm. And you know, there was a certain sense of arrogance that the MDC Alliance had at some point in their negotiations, particularly with Joyce Mujuru and with Code Yamangoma. And the agreements fell apart because basically Joyce Mujuru said, I can't be a part of a party called MDC Alliance. And that's the same thing that Elton Mangoma said.
Yeah.
And they've been proven right. Because I remember I was so angry and I didn't have faith. I was like, why would you do that? You guys are doing bad. You know, you need to negotiate in better faith. You can make some concessions, but clearly, it was a waste of time.
A complete waste of time. And it would have done them, they would have done themselves a disservice to have made concessions, because they are strong.
The MDC is strong. And on the other front, though, I think bringing the original MDC together, that's what this whole alliance should have been called, helped in some places, helped familiar faces, helped the party, helped the alliance. It should have just been an alliance of the original MDC members. If Kupe had been in there, then maybe would have gotten even more parliamentary seats.
Yeah.
No, it should have just been a reunification of MDC.
So it's, I mean, quite interesting what's happened. Obviously, the presidential result is being challenged by the MDC. Nelson Chamisa insists that he won the election. He says that Emmerson Mnangagwa himself knows that Chamisa won the election. And that process is ongoing. We'll see what happens this week. They have 7 days in which to challenge. And I think, I don't know if they've done so. I haven't been following. But I do know that they are going to do so. So we'll see what happens there, and then sort of discuss more on just the lives of the political parties and their futures once there is clarity around the political system.
I think we can't really finish the podcast without just, you know, maybe acknowledging that lives were lost immediately in protest after the election. And we've, so, I mean, perhaps for people who are wondering why we haven't touched it, personally, it's still quite fresh. And for those who know, it's quite a personal situation in as far as who's being blamed for the incitement and police things. So I don't think I'll do you guys any favors by really going deep into it. The facts
just, we spoke about Zek's running of the election in terms of just the simple conduct and process, where for me they then failed was in the results. And I know, we all knew and agreed that they would take, how many days did they agree to? 5 days was what it was to announce the results. But it was obviously a very sensitive position. And this comes back to the issue of communication that I've argued with Zek from the jump, in that their communication was just, again, very poor. They were making announcements about making announcements. You know, they were saying, well, we'll be back at such a time to tell you that we'll be back at such a time to tell you what time we're going to announce this particular result, which it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. And when you have an election which people went into saying that you are acting in bad faith, I think they had a particular duty to calm people's fears around certain things. So obviously, election results were waiting for election results, and then now this is on Zek, where I had issues with. But as election results were waiting for, Monday people voted. Tuesday there were no Tuesday results started to come in. Maneru. Wednesday people are waiting for presidential results and they still aren't out. And the MDC or MDC supporters came into the city. Now this is where it gets tricky, because different people will tell you different things. But anyway, there were MDC supporters gathered at Harvest, or what's it, Morgan Tsvangirai House is what it's called now, right?
Yeah.
And then they decided, or some people decided, that they were going to protest at ZEC. It's one of the places that they went to.
The protesters at Harvest House for most of the day were there, and then they were moved on. So people were peacefully at Harvest House the whole day, and then riot police cleared out Harvest House. So there was the first skirmishes and the first kerfuffles that occurred were at Harvest House or at Morgan Tsvangirai House when they were clearing the road because they had been blocking the road. So the police said, you can't be here anymore. And then they said, fine, we're going to ZEC.
Okay. And,
but by that time, so here's another thing. By the time there were people who were, there was already other, you know, incidences happening in town while the majority of the crowd was being cleared from Harvest House. So by that time, the cars at near ZANU-PF already started burning, and the stones and things that had happened. So by the time the police arrived at Harvest House, it was in response to people saying, "Oh, stuff is going down in town." And but those people from Harvest House really weren't involved, and that's the majority of the crowd. The rest of the crowd, or the other people that were being violent, were already dispersed throughout the cities in the first place. And I will tell you this, I've been present in a number of protests, and I've actually was there in the 2016 one, the last time that the riot police really sprayed people and tear gassed people, in 2016, when they were running battles. And And you don't congregate in big groups if you want to throw stones. You know, I got my phone hit out of my hand because these guys were like, "Don't record us." And basically, what happens is they decide to shut the place down. And from 2016, it's not just my supporters. You get even the layabouts, my street kids that are there, the ones who start throwing stones, and people who are generally in town anyway. And that's not to say they don't support MDC. I'm not, I don't know who they support, but my understanding of these scenarios as having participated in them is that the people that you see throwing stones, the people that you'll be doing there, are likely already in town. Like they are, you know, ne'er-do-wells. I suppose that's not even fair. They're just unemployed youths that are already there. No one really gets in a combi to come and protest or celebrate and decides to start burning cars. It's more likely boys and tunas.
So that is, you know, what, so yeah, so what then transpired is, you know, these, as you mentioned, these protests then turned violent, and the army then stepped in after. So, you know, again, it's the story or the narrative is very difficult to get because there's no clear indication of what it is that actually happened or at what point people came into these things. But protesters were gathered at different places around the city, somewhere at ZEC, somewhere at HICC, or along that road outside ZANU-PF, you know. People were bringing down Mnangagwa billboards and such. Cars were burning. Anyway, after the police commissioner of the police, Commissioner Matanga, says that he requested the presence of the army because he needed support and help. And the army came into the streets and opened fire indiscriminately on civilians, and six people lost their lives, sadly, and unfortunately lost their lives. And you know, all of this was broadcast. It was live. It was the world.
Videos were online immediately.
Immediately, the eyes of the world are watching, and it was savage. That's how I'd, you know, describe it. There's the one where the guy was literally firing, and you know, one of his fellow soldiers had to come and stop him, literally, you know, hit him on the back to say stop. There's another video where some guy, a combi driver stopped, made to lie on the ground, and he's beaten, and then he goes on his way. It was not pretty. It was not pretty at all. It was, it was heartbreaking, actually, and very disheartening to look at, simply from, especially when you're coming from an election, one of perhaps the most peaceful election we've had in recent years. But also, you've got a nation with hope. Regardless of what the result was going to be, there was a level of hope that we are turning a corner. And this set us back in so many ways that it was just extremely, extremely disappointing, first and foremost, to see. And then it was just wrong and pure evil. And for me, it was a why. That's what I don't get. You know, if the protesters were armed, I could say, okay, well, you know, this is a high level situation. But it wasn't that. And it wasn't even, it was random people getting shot at. I've seen, and you spoke about 2016 protests. I've been in them. I've seen the water cannons. I've been, in that situation. I've seen the tear gas. I've been in that situation. I understand.
I remember we were there when they were burning the ZBC car.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can view that. I still can't come to the terms that they were soldiers opening fire on the streets of Harare. Like it really, that one, I'm still failing to comprehend why they would fire a gun on the streets of Harare like that. That one video where the guy was literally just letting shooting. It rain. To be fair, I don't know. One, I don't know how many people he hit, but the way he was firing, he really could have killed a lot of people.
A lot more than they did.
He, so that for me was, really, really, it marred the election, and it made the election a sad affair.
It's marred Zimbabwe, Chris.
No, definitely.
Like the election itself, but like I tongue-in-cheek called Welcome to the Second Republic, but we can't honestly, I mean, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. And you start thinking, well, maybe Mugabe was the restraining factor in all this. Maybe he was the moderator.
Maybe he's the one
that diluted, just based on his pure civilian influence, diluted the excesses of the military element.
The
military ties and the government ties need to be severed with surgical precision. But I don't think that there's either the political will or the ability to do so.
Well, now this is my question. Is, obviously my question is, who ordered it? Logically, anybody can tell you that this closes Zimbabwe for business. It simply just because of the fact that the eyes of the world are watching. There's no way. If you're telling me that these guys just don't understand the way the media works, or modern media works and social media works, and they thought that this was something that they could shut down and cover up, then I think we have massive problems on our hand. But I don't think that they're that dumb. I really don't think that that's it. I don't want to speculate, but I really would like some answers. And I think there's a lot of investigative work that
going on
people
behind the scenes.
That people can do. Like, I think it takes a bit of guts and courage, but I think there is something to this. And also, if we then go to the what happened on the Friday at the MDC press conference with the journalists and the police, which, you know, they've said, or George Charamba came out and said, could it was a lapse of in the command. So clearly somebody gave the order for something to happen there. But we all knew that there was going to be a press conference. We knew on social media that there was a press conference called at Bronte long before it even took place, right? If the journalists know that there's a press conference happening, if we know on social media that there's a press conference happening, then how is it that within the command they think it's a rally?
No, it was. If it wasn't for the journalists there, they were going to arrest Nelson Chamisa in front there. Like, literally, the reason it was called at Bronte was for that exact reason, because Bronte is where most of the international observers are staying. Besides the Rainbow Towers, the decision to have it there and not at Harvest House. Have you thought of that?
No, it's literally
like calling a press conference as the opposition leader in an embassy.
You know what? I completely understand, right, from that logical point of view, right? But my thing is, okay, fair and fine. They're saying that if you know, they wanted to arrest Nelson Chamisa. But for me, it's the eyes of the world are watching, and it's live. This isn't something that comes on to ZBC News at 8 p.m. where you can doctor the story. This is people literally play-by-play action live.
Yeah, and then you have SK Moyo come down and say this press conference must be stopped.
No, he said the press conference must go on.
Oh, okay, okay.
SK Moyo came. So the police were there. They stopped it, right?
So who was the police officer speaking to on the phone who was saying stop it, is the question.
I don't know. This is my question, is who gave the order for the police to go there? Go out there.
Before we even get to the press conference, Chris, I'm also thinking about when why has no one asked E.G., did you know that Presidential Guard was deployed on the streets? Like, these are your own personal security.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because I have it on good authority that those guys, some of the soldiers that made up the people on the streets, that they were Presidential Guard.
I honestly think that, you know, ED said, oh, we're going to have a commission of inquiry and blah, blah, blah. There actually needs to be one, first and foremost. And I hope he comes good on that.
But last time they had a commission of inquiry, it was the Dumbuchene report, which still hasn't been reported. Who hasn't been released to the public for public consumption.
But you see, the thing is, I do hope that there are people to put pressure on this issue. Because this was something that should never have happened. There's absolutely no excuse. And I don't tolerate the manner in which the protests went down. I also don't tolerate some of the things that happened prior. You know, I can talk about Bondo's video. I can talk about a number of things in terms of, I think, even in just in terms of the leadership aspect of it. I really think that, yes, you know, there was every right for Chamisa to say what he felt about the elections. But I also think that at the same time, you can call for calm and patience amongst your supporters, simply on the fact that you knew that it could take up to 5 days to release the results. This was something that came out long before the election, and I think you could have just said, okay, let's give them up until this point, right? If you're so confident in your victory, you say, okay, let's give them, we're collecting evidence in the meantime. But that's, you know, those are some of the things that I fear where the leadership of the opposition let me down, or let the people down, rather.
That's a shared sentiment by a lot of people.
Yeah.
Dealing with Zek, as you've seen over the last 18 months, they have done nothing without pressure. How the opposition behaved after this election is very, very little different from the NERA demonstrations, from any protest that has been against Zek all throughout the process, which has actually led Zek to take action in some of their ways. Without that, if Zeg hadn't made that the minimum standard that they need to have people on the streets or in front of their building petition them before they did anything, then perhaps opposition would have behaved differently. But the minimum standard for a point of negotiation with Zeg has been protests.
I hear you, Henry, but at the same time,
talking about saying we are not going to accept any result but our own. We're not going to. That's something we can speak to.
No, okay. First, there was that, right? But the second thing is, they agreed to the terms and conditions. This was something that came out, I think, when the roadmap came out long before, and it said up to 5 days. This was something well known. It's not something. It's unlike 2008, where results were just being deliberately delayed, and you had no clue. ZEC was, they had not released the presidential result, but they were within their window.
Yeah,
and
Chris,
they hadn't done it.
I understand. I almost agree. The environment we're working in is very different. The question was, well, you now have said, and this is another thing you're talking about, Ozek's own communication, we've agreed that all command center, all the results are in. So the reason for the slowdown in the process didn't make any sense to most people.
I hear you, which is why for me, and this is what it is, which is why for me it was the duty of the leadership, because these people had people who Zeg Kwacho, what's his name, was there, Douglas Wonzora was there, Komichi was there.
Komichi was saying this is unacceptable. They're the ones that said, look, guys, this is unacceptable.
Right? But what it was is, for me, is where the lead, and this is, again, it comes down to a leadership issue, is to find the compromise. Simply because of where the tensions were. And I'm not saying that, this is not to put blame on them for what then happened. I'm just saying that I really do believe in the situation there was need for better leadership from everybody. I don't think that the leadership lived up to the place that it should have been. I think that there are different ways in which they could have communicated with their people. That's just my opinion on the matter.
Yeah. I will reluctantly take that as a point. Like I said earlier, like, this is way too close to home and way too personal. And I've got my own feelings that go over and above the acknowledged bias that I have. So I'm trying to be as calm and objective as possible.
No, definitely.
At the end of the day, the...
Now this is where I was going and saying that, regardless, however, of whatever then transpired with the MDC, it didn't warrant that kind of response. There's nothing that warrants that kind of response. Which some might then go back and say, well, clearly the MDC wasn't out of line or whatever the case might be, but it didn't warrant that kind of response, and it's disappointing that that was the response that was given.
And here's the thing, Chris, is the ultimate question that I can't help but ask myself is, like, kanama wina me se mugurayawan barod. You have
it's a good question,
better trained, I suppose they might be better trained police officers, but you have militarily trained officers in South Africa that see whole townships burn without a single casualty.
Yeah, I mean, you see, so now this is the thing, is that it begs a lot of questions, and I don't think that there is I don't think that there's something that we can clearly determine from what happened there. It still baffles the mind, and I really simply would just, like a lot of people, would just want answers to some of these questions. And it puts in doubt, for me, the unity that exists within ZANU-PF and within the government. It makes me think that there are factions at play. It makes me think that there are, you know, there's underhand things going on. I immediately then also think about the White City bombing, and we still don't have answers for that. Now I'm even more suspicious, because, you know, if we then say, okay, there's two centers of power,
whom would I, look, maybe we should have a full speculation episode.
maybe we can, because
this is a long episode, but we might as well finish this thought. You're saying, yeah, who's the two centers of power? Because I would assume the military guys and SP Moyo, Chiwenga, and Emerson would have been together. But SP Moyo is tweeting about MDC leaders needed to be arrested in court and brought to justice. Which,
you know, the thing is
the opposite of what some other people in the government are saying.
At this stage, I honestly don't know, and it's more speculation, but I'm at pains to think that you actually have a united government. I don't think so. I think there's definitely, you know, two centers, one on the ED side, which is the political side, and one on the military side. I don't know whose thing, but this again is just speculation, and simply based on the fact that ED's message and the things that he's been trying to do not coincide with the actions that took place last week at all. And that, I'd be very surprised if that was
ED's Lord Timothy Bell tailored message is very different from ED, the real person.
Yeah, well, this is true. Now, what it is, though, is that I think that he himself panics, and a lot of the things. So, if we think of back to election or the day before election, when Mugabe came out and did his thing, and ED made that video, that was uncharacteristic. That was definitely not something that was planned by, you know, the people that have been running his PR. That was him panicked and working with some people, don't know who they are, but one of the internal groups who then did that.
But that means someone close enough is close enough to him to get him to sit down and record a message when his eyes are red and bleary, like he's...
Yeah, but look, now this is the thing, is that it's a very good point. It's now starting to think of who are the people that are around him and what sort of communications happen at what times, and in terms of for what sort of decisions. And it could be, actually, that, you know, he was in charge and somebody close to him at the time was like, well, we have to deal with this decisively, and he made a snap decision. It could be, or it could be someone else did it, you know, with the means and the power to do it. But I want to speak to Valerio. He's somebody who needs to come out and tell us what happened with his, because they were his men. As much as they were under the command of Matanga, who says they were Valerio's men. So Valerio must tell us who his men were. If these men were seconded from the army, we must know who dispatched them. Who actually said, okay, Indana Farai, Indana Tongai, Indana, you know, all these guys, collect these guys, and these are the guys to go. From which unit were they dispatched? What were the instructions that they were given when they were dispatched? These are some of the things that need to come to light.
And here's the thing. here's an actually interesting thing. If you listen to Emerson's language, he said we'll put in a commission of inquiry.
Yeah.
Saying the police have no ability, as well as he doesn't believe in the independence or the ability of the army or its leadership to deliver the people who would have done it to justice. Like either he's admitting I'm not in power or he's this ruthless. And that's the only way. I mean, look, the world's news cycle is so fast these days that genuinely I believe that he threw the dice in the air and he said, look, Trump is going to say something ridiculous in 3 days and the people who are going to do business with us anyway, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, are still going to do business with us. As much as we would want it to be in the Commonwealth, that really wasn't going to affect our business deals as much as you know, the business with Russia and China. So he rolled the dice and said, look, I don't need these people as much as I need my people to fear me and to respect me. He maybe is even angry that he only got 50% of the vote and feels betrayed. I liberated you guys from Gabed. You have the audacity to protest against me. You have the audacity to not vote against me, to not vote for me. You know, so cool, I'll show you. Isusu ka takava kundu, we can always go back. And that's it. You've now put your stamp of authority, and you can still say I'm soft as wool, it was a lapse in judgment. But the people of Harare are going to remember for as long as you rule. So it may have been a calculated decision that you can't start your term off by accepting dissent. But you only have to do it once and you never have to do it again.
You know, it very well could be. I honestly don't know.
I mean, if we're going to accept that that's the level of reasoning, that's how calculated these men are in being able to run a coup, that's, for me, that would be the then level of reasoning that you'd have to give them, that cold Machiavellian calculating one. If we say, well, they bungled through the coup, and if it wasn't for Chiwenga putting his tanks there, Emerson would never have flown back. He really had no control over the situation, and it just happened to be fortunate that people decided to march and everything worked out in favor and no one was really in control. Then, cool. Then I will believe the other story, but two things can't be true at once.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's the thing, is I can't definitively come out and say, Kuti, you know what, yes, there's two sides, or it was one person making the decision, or it was, you know, for them it was a show of force. I still the show of force angle doesn't work for me. Only to the extent that
the international observers are still here.
The past 8-9 months would have then been for nothing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. if you had this card at the back of your hand, then I think they would have moved a lot differently over the last 8-9 months.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me. And even in terms of, you know, just even in terms of the way the election has panned out, and it hasn't been perfect, but inviting the world's media to come watch, inviting all these observers, it puts a lot of strain on you. Simply, if you're saying, Kuti, we're going to rig this election with all these eyes watching, you must have one damn sophisticated system of rigging. You know what I mean? Or you must have done it, Kudara. And obviously, there's all these other issues that were brought up in terms of intimidation, in terms of vote buying, you know, food allocation, using state resources. These are some of the things that are part of the part of the political culture in Zimbabwe.
I mean, I've always believed that if you want to beat ZANU-PF, you have to beat them by 20%, and they'll give you a win by 5%.
Now, this is my thing, is that. But at the same time, that's one aspect of it, and this is one aspect that observers also spoke about in terms of, you know, the uneven playing field. But in terms of ballot box stuffing and others, you know, moving X's and whatever other things that, you know, have been brought up, whatever rigging methods people, whatever it must be, with that level of scrutiny, it must be extremely sophisticated. However, now coming to the issue of scrutiny, is how scrutinized were these elections? You know, observers didn't go everywhere. MDC didn't have agents everywhere. And where were the gaps? And did ZANU-PF know where the gaps were going to be and adjust for that before?
Here's for me, man. Look, we can do a proper postmortem when it's all finished, but ERC and all these other organizations had their funding cut. The only independent election observer body that was sort of left in ZIM with full funding was Zimbabwe Election Support Network, which is funded directly out of the ambassador's office. It's DFID funding, which is British funded. And they had a very favorable report for the election, whereas the American funded guys were defunded. First of all, before Harry Thomas Jr. left the country, but they also just didn't have the ability to double check some of the claims. So I think there was some manipulation in terms of where the gaps were. My Maziru constituency, we've always spoken about polling station based voters, how it protects the opposition vote in urban areas, but actually goes against opposition votes in rural areas in a way. And those are things they know. So where you see Maziru polling stations where Chamisa or whoever else got zero, you know whoever is running that cell, they know each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, there was I'm not sure if it was BBC or Al Jazeera or one of these, Sky, I think it was. They went to one of these rural constituencies and they saw one of the guys that was literally taking names of the people that were coming to vote. So these are things that we know happen. You know, you're marked on a register,
And if there's 300 at you at that polling station and ZANU doesn't get 300 votes, one over Oziot, Tawanda, any girlfriend with MDC, Saga, maybe they also voted MDC.
Yes. So there's definitely all these.
But we go ahead with ourselves. I think we need to bring it back and tighten up. This is a post election.
Episode.
Wait the any legal challenge the MDC is going to get. We pray and supplicant for peace in the country, and we say, overall I'll give it a solid C minus as an election. Room for improvement.
Loads of room for improvement. Like I said...
But definitely better than 2013 or 2008.
Yeah, so for me, you know, a C is a decent grade for it. As I said, the biggest... Had Wednesday not happened, I think it would have, you know, definitely stayed about a C. But since Wednesday happened, I think that mars it for me, you know what I mean? And it puts it in the D region. I await the results from the court case. I was going to say though, this is something that I've been thinking about, and again, I think it's the violence that takes everything away from this election. But in the event that the challenge falls through and ED remains, How does the international community view this election? And one of the things that I've been, you know, trying to look at or just compare it with is the Kenyan election. Kenya doesn't have sanctions on it, but you know, that's an actual election where a result was nullified by their courts. And everyone has sort of come to terms with what's happened in Kenya or with that election. So I'm just wondering, in terms of this election, what a final verdict from people might then be in terms of how this election panned out. I know, obviously, there were a lot of clauses in Zidera and a lot of rules and basic minimums or standards that were expected to have been met. From the jump, I didn't think we were ever going to do so. And that it's based on a lot of issues. Some are institutional, some are historical. But I just sort of wonder, as you know, you rated it a C, but just how is this election rated overall, and what can be done to improve as we go forward? A lot of recommendations have to do with electoral law reform, which I do hope comes. You know, obviously that's something to discuss, but I do think we are a step in the right direction, bar the soldiers killing people. I think we are definitely, we've moved a step in the right direction from where we were previously.
Yeah.
And that's a reflection in the result as well. It's a contested election.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. All right.
But yeah, I think we can end there.
We can end there. I think we will continue going backwards and forwards. Look, all we know is we can continue. We're better than this, and we can continue being better than this.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think we can end there. We'll wait and see what results come from court applications. If I'm not mistaken, they have to file within 7 days. Inauguration, you have to wait at least 9 days. And I think the 9 days is to accommodate that 7 days. If there is a challenge, then I think there's going to be a further delay because the Constitutional Court has to give a response within 14 days. So they have a minimum of up to 14 days. So we could have an inauguration this weekend, or we could have an inauguration.
If the MDC was smart, they'll just pick 25 constituencies and challenge 40,000 votes. And that'll be enough to take it to a runoff.
Yeah.
If they got the challenge through. And there's constituencies you can pick. If you can invalidate, like, you literally can say, this constituency wasn't right because some people didn't have VR. Like, you know, there's enough just administrate. Like if you look at that that one that was overturned and given to MDC, there's enough of that throughout the election. If you have forensics, if you're doing it to overturn or at least, you know, let's say 10 constituencies, possibly.
Do they have enough time to put together such a case in 7 days or within 7 days?
I don't think they will. And I don't think that the Zimbabwean courts have the judicial activism of the Kenyan courts. I don't think a Zimbabwean court would ever declare an election invalid.
I doubt it.
I don't see it happening. But anyway.
But yeah, let's see what happens.
Zimbabwe is open for business, guys.
Zimbabwe is open for business.
And
I love the way he says business.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Cheers.